MechCast, Sunday, February 16th, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I am pretty excited about today's episode because I am going to share with you something that I've been wanting to cover here on the MechCast for a while. Actually, since about the release of the Mac Pro, or maybe even way back to the announcement. It's something we've touched on in a few episodes, but we really haven't dove into in any significant way, at least not from a practical side of things, from a what is the solution to this problem side of things. And I'm talking about the sort of hole, and again, we've mentioned this on the MacCast before, the hole in the Pro Mac market. We know we have the iMac Pro, we know we have the Mac Pro, and those are Pro machines, but they also come at a very heavy price tag when compared to the prior generation Pro systems that they replace. And when you say Pro in the Macintosh world, in the Apple world, you're talking about a wide, wide range of users, and there's a whole spectrum of people who are working professionally with their Macs. And so that Pro moniker can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. And it's become very clear where Apple is defining that Pro market with the price point and the specs of these systems like the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro. And it is targeted much higher, or at the very least, at a much higher price point than the previous generation. And there's a lot of working professionals out there that have been sort of left wondering, what is the Mac system for me? Like, where do I fit in that lineup? And is it an iMac? Is it a MacBook Pro? What is that system? And it turns out there's a system in the lineup that we don't talk about that frequently, but that one that might be the perfect solution for pros out there. And I think it might surprise you. So we're going to get into that in this episode. And I'm going to do that with the help of a friend because, you know, I do a podcast and you could argue, you know, I do pro stuff, but I'm not really a pro. I guess I am at my office. And we're going to talk about the same system because my office is actually moving to these systems as well. So, you know, in that professional capacity, I do. But I really wanted to talk to somebody who day in, day out is working sort of in that pro space where he's not working for a film studio. He's not doing high-end 3D graphics and rendering for, you know, video games, or it's a different kind of professional, but he's definitely a working professional, working in industry, doing higher end stuff. And he's a Mac fan. And that's my friend, Scott Johnson from the Frog Pants Network, from a bunch of great podcasts over on that network, including a couple of my favorites, The Morning Stream and Film Sack. Those are the ones that I'm very into, but he does a whole host of other shows, all focused around nerd and tech and the topics that we're all into. And he is a working professional. He's an artist. He is a video streamer. He is a podcaster. And he was faced with this dilemma. And so I wanted to sit him down. I wanted to talk to him about the whole process he went through in deciding on the system he ultimately decided on. And again, I think it's going to surprise you. It's pretty amazing, and it is great, a great story. So I'm going to share that with you in this episode. So a little bit different than our other episodes, but you know, looking at the news, there's not a lot happening right now, to be honest. There's a few stories out there, and we'll get to those in a couple days back on a regular MacCast. But I think you're really going to enjoy this one, and I look forward to hearing your feedback on this, and especially maybe continuing the conversation that I have with Scott with you. So if after this episode it sparks some ideas or you have some thoughts or opinions you want to share, please share those with us, maccast@gmail.com. So that's what we're going to be getting to in this episode. Before I get started, though, I do want to take a quick minute and thank a show sponsor. and that is Linode. Look, if you need hosting, really take a look at Linode. If you want to put up a website, if you need a server, Linode is an amazing option. With Linode, you can instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can literally get up and running in seconds. And best of all, you get your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and you can even pick from any one of their 10 node locations. As a matter of fact, they just opened their newest data center in Mumbai, India, and it's built using their most up-to-date hardware, next-generation network backbone, and it allows you to comply with in-country data protection requirements, all while taking advantage of Linode's technology and tools. And best of all, they're giving new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And what I love about Linode is it's more than just hosting. With Linode, you get all of the options and choices you could want or need to build a server with the services and features that you need for whatever project you're working on. So it could be a website, it could be a version control system, it could be continuous integration and delivery environments, it could be hosted services, distributed applications, dedicated CPU servers, doesn't matter. You can build it on Linode. And everything they have, all the servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And again, you can pick from any of those 10 worldwide data centers. And best of all, and something I really like and appreciate, is that their pricing is simple. No surprise fees. You're going to pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And they have a great control panel. As a matter of fact, they just updated their cloud manager with features that include an improved user interface that makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your pricing and plans even easier than it was before. And it is a really nice control panel. I've dealt with a lot of control panels, and I can hands down say theirs is one of the cleanest and easiest to use. So if you need a server and you need it now, head to linode.com/maccast, set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com/maccast, and a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the show. So let's just jump right in. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk with my friend Scott all about his Pro system and what he ended up choosing when he was upgrading from a 2013 Mac Pro. So here's Scott. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm good, Adam. It's fantastic to be with you again after too long of a time period.
I think it's been years, like literally.
It feels like it, but I mean, it probably has been, but I see you a lot, like every year, usually at a thing. And so it feels like we're hanging out more than we do, but it bums me out when I realize how long it's been. So I'm very, very glad to be here with you today.
Yeah. And I've been wanting to actually do this one for a little while. Actually, I think we talked back at one of those events about getting together for something else. I think just talking about doing pro work with Macs and things like that. But what happened recently, it's even more interesting for me because I often listen to the morning stream. So I hear you and Brian many days. So it feels for me like I just, you know, had a conversation with you or at least listened to you very recently. But in one of those, you mentioned you had made a transition. For people who maybe don't know, maybe we should back up. So maybe where we should start is talk a little bit about, for people who might not be familiar with your work or what you do, you basically use Macs in a pro capacity. So do you want to like maybe just kind of introduce yourself and talk a little bit about how you have been using your Mac and the kinds of work that you do? Because you kind of have two areas, right? You have your art and then you have your podcast stuff. So
yeah, and it turns out Macs have always been for me the choice for those kind of, for both ends of my production world. And I've been doing that pretty solidly on the Mac side since 2004 or so. And since then, and so, you know, here and there in the past before that, but really that's when I kind of locked in and realized that both on the audio production side, as well as my art and tablet use and that sort of stuff, it just felt like the better ecosystem to be in. And I still believe that to be true today, which is, we'll get to why that's frustrating in a minute. But I do a lot of art and I do a lot of recording and video and other stuff. And I really like the platform for all of that. So recently I ended up being in the market for an upgrade. It's been a while. I bought a 2013 Mac Pro, the little trash can looking thing, back in 2013. And it served me incredibly well. I never really had any issues with it. Although I guess initially there was a video card recall thing. They fixed that though, and it was no problem. But as usual, my Macs last forever. That thing still kicking. I gave it to my daughter. She's using it now, and it's a huge improvement for her over what she was doing. So just a great box, but it was definitely showing a little bit of its age, mostly in the CPU and in the GPU department. And I thought, well, it's time to upgrade. And I felt this way maybe a couple years ago, but I kept thinking, I'm going to hold out. I'm going to hold out until I see what they do with the Pro again, because it's been so long since they refreshed it. Let's see what they're going to do. And I waited and I waited, and the iMac Pro happened. And for a hot minute, I went, oh, this might be it. And then I saw the price tag and went, this is not it. This is still too much. That's a lot more than I was going to, that I paid for the Mac Pro I'm currently using. And they don't have a level there for me, really. So I guess I need to just see what the regular Pro is going to look like, because that won't have a screen. That saves money in theory, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So that one comes around and it's like, oh my Lord, if I want to properly configure this, I'm at least $8,000, at least that. And do I want it? Of course I do. Of course everyone does. Everybody wants that machine. But they leapfrogged the Pro stuff away. We were talking before the show, we hate the term prosumer. And I do too. Right. I can't stand it. But they had a nice middle ground before. It was like, I can afford a configuration here. This is workable for me. It's still expensive. I'm going to pay more than I will for an equivalent PC. But that means I get a Mac OS. I get the ecosystem I want. I get the strength of the platform. This is the way I want to go. But now they've just priced me out of the market. And I, for a hot minute there, was considering, oh my gosh, about a two-week period where I was looking at PC configurations. And I was almost ready to pull the trigger. The problem is, like a lot of the stuff I do for production stuff, even though a lot of it's cross-platform, like you know, Adobe Suite and all that, I was running into some problems, big problems for me, some things that I need and use that the PC just had no equivalent for. Not to mention, I just think Mac OS, despite some of its, you know, recent issues with the turnover to 64-bit only and all of that, it's a really reliable workhorse of a piece of software, and I just can rely on it. I love Mac OS, and I'm not going to do a Hackintosh, because what am I, some kind of weirdo? You know what I mean?
Well, you could. I mean, a lot of people take that route, right?
Well, by weirdo, I mean, you know, as a business that has to like report things and, you know,
there you go,
fly straight. I can't really do a thing that's like that against terms of service without it being a problem. So
Well, and also it's risky from a technology standpoint, because you already mentioned like a big part of why you need this workflow is reliability, right? So you need to be able to upgrade when you upgrade, and you can't have to spend all that time. Like the dilemma of a Hackintosh, right, is that you're cobbling something together that's not supported. And so if something goes wrong or something goes sideways, you're kind of left on your own, right?
Right.
And most businesses can't operate like that. I mean, if you're doing this stuff professionally, which is the whole point of what we're talking about here, you know, you can't rely on, you need to rely on your machine, I guess is the thing to say.
It's a huge factor. Like I've got a PC, a very nice gaming PC that I love and I use for gaming and stuff. But you have a Mac show, obviously, we're very focused on Macs here and stuff. But I just cannot rely on Windows the way I can on Mac. I just can't. I've tried. I do the best I can. It can get the job done. You can do better with certain hardware and really lock in stuff that's, you know, best for Windows 10. But there's a lot about that ecosystem that just feels like it's got holes in it, and I need not to feel that way. if I'm gonna throw all my guts over there, I need it to be a softer landing, and it just isn't. So it was a real bummer. I felt stuck there for a while there, for about 3 weeks. I was just like in a bit of a quandary. I'm like, all right, well, the Mac Pro is out and we know the price. I know what a now 3-year-old aging iMac Pro costs, and it's still $5,000 to start. What am I going to do? And one of the options for me, dude, was I did not want to go backwards. I didn't want to go back to a regular old iMac. They're great machines, don't get me wrong, but I don't want a hybrid drive. I want all SSD. There's choices I need in a more of a Pro environment. I never want another spinning drive again unless it's external for backup or something. And so that was one huge hang up for me. And so I was really in a pooper. And the one bright light I thought I got was the Mac Pro 16 inch came out at what seems like actually a very reasonable price for that device.
Oh, the MacBook Pro.
Yeah, the MacBook Pro. And so for a hot minute, I was like, all right, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll just dock the crap out of that thing. But then part of me is like, it's so, I don't like the idea of that I'm compromising and getting a notebook, but not benefiting from all the features of a notebook unless I leave town or something. Oh, big time. Yeah. But as a desktop perspective, I was like, well, I just want the guts and power of that thing and not the notebook part. Like, can I just have that? And that's the part of their line that seems to be missing. Until I finally ended up with what I ended up with.
Yeah. So, but just before we get into that, I'm curious just to understand what kinds of things that you were doing that put you into that pro market at the level Apple was before they decided, well, our pro market is much, you know, a much higher price point, right? So what kinds of things were you relying on with the 2013 Mac Pro? And what went into the decision to buy that machine?
So prior to that one, I had a Mac Pro 2006, something like that. And it was the old tower, and I loved that thing, and it was great. But again, you know, every machine after about 7 or 8 years, you're starting to run into performance issues. Some of my software was now out of date because, you know, anything past Mountain Lion or whatever it was a and things like that. And so the decision there was just to sort of continue on in the line. I was like, well, I'm just going to get whatever the current Mac Pro is because this has served me so well and I'm ready for the next one. And I actually really like the form factor of that little can. I still do. I think it's cool. The way it does heat dispersal and super easy to open and clean out and, you know, keep in a nice, small, organized place. I think it's great. People give that thing all kinds of crap for its style, but I actually really like it. You know, upgradability issues aside. It was a neat little experiment, I think, for Apple. But anyway, it was a no-brainer because, again, I'm in the same price range as the previous stuff. So they didn't go crazy. It wasn't like outrageously more expensive than the previous line. Everything was in line, give or take some inflation, but it was roughly what I was used to with the previous Pro. And I thought that's what I would just do in the next, whatever the next round was, that would be similar to that. And when that thing hit and they said minimum $5,999 as a starting point, and then, you know, forgetting about the screen, which is awesome, but there's no way anyone's in their right mind affords that thing. And, you know, any other peripherals, if I'm starting just at the basics, I'm still paying extreme amounts of money for a machine that it will definitely do what I need it to do, but I'm also compromising because I can't do any of the upgrades I would really normally want to do. Because we're already so far out of the price range. And this isn't me saying Apple's overcharging or that it's too expensive for what's in it. I think that's all legitimately priced. It's just that they're making a machine that used to be one category that caught more of us on the back end. And they pushed it way over here where it's just for some big studio that have three artists working all the time and they just buy three of these and they get a corporate discount and, you know, everyone does their job. And to me, that's an oversight on Apple's part. If anything, they were erring too much on the other side to back in the day. Everything seemed like it was shifting more toward consumer products and appeasing the iPad, iPhone sort of market, which was, you know, the lower cost market. And they were doing that kind of across the board. Things were losing power to be more consumer friendly. And then something clicked over there. And I don't know, Phil Schiller had a weird dream or I don't know what. And they said, nope, back to the extreme again. And now they've jumped all the way over there. So it just felt like there was a big gap of potential that they just skipped right over. And so there was entry level and there was extreme high end. What happened to our middle ground?
Right. And that middle ground for you is what, I mean, so you're doing on a daily basis, you're doing art. So I'm imagining things like Photoshop and, you know, dealing with probably large layered files there, lots of layers, that sort of work. And then you also have your audio production and video production with the podcast, right? So I'm imagining a big reason you were in that pro space had to do with your workflows and how long it takes you to produce and render and put things together.
Yeah, 100%. Plus wrapped in a skin of reliability, which is another, is super key, and I can't emphasize it enough. So yes, like every day there is audio editing and audio recording and multiple tracks being done all at the same time, like lots of multi-threading going on. And I needed that to not only maintain, but improve with, you know, some speed bumps. Video, I want fast video encoding. I want to be able to produce stuff quickly with Premiere and things like that. And like you mentioned, Photoshop, Illustrator, pretty much the entire suite, plus a lot more stuff to do with, like, you know, actual live streaming and other things. I wanted all of that stuff to continue to, you know, work well, and new versions of it to not be bogging down this older setup. So that, that's why it seemed like the natural thing. Plus, you know, I've come to rely on some crazy stuff that I never thought I would care about. Like AirDrop is one of my favorite things on the planet. Like, I love AirDrop. And I know there's some equivalent stuff you can do with Android and Chrome and stuff like that. But the sheer fact that I can take an iPad Pro, which I think currently is and is still the best drawing tool for artists right now, that and a pen, or pencil rather, those, to be able to work on multi-layered files and do what I got to do on that device, and then say, all right, I'm done, and have that thing send directly to my Mac in no time. Just over the air, done, and now open on Photoshop for some other finishing work or whatever I may need to do to, you know, export it, get it ready for print, whatever, is such an easy workflow. It's just, I've gotten to rely on it so much that without it, I feel naked and weird. I don't like it. It's very, very good. And that combined with, like, more iCloud storage stuff, the way I handle all my show files now and everything else, I have access to this stuff everywhere. So the ecosystem really does play a big role in it. Despite the fact that, yeah, on Windows, I can even install iCloud and I can get some of that going, but it's not nearly as usable. It's not as intuitive by any stretch. And I just don't have the full system of workflow happening the way I need it to. And that's just on the art side, you know, on the audio production side and the video side, just being able to move this stuff around quickly and efficiently between devices has just been huge for me. So, yeah, like I knew that, I mean, even though I was poking around at PC options, I just knew I was going to end up back in the Mac. I just knew it. Like I just knew it was folly for me to be poking around anywhere else and that I was just going to have to either bite the bullet. Like Kim and I were like, all right, well, let's see, how can this even be done? Can we do, right. What do we do? And it was frustrating because, you know, I have a fun little enterprise, but I'm not rolling in it. So it was one of those deals where I couldn't just throw money at this, and Apple doesn't do influencers. So there's no big break there. So yeah, like, so in the end I had to figure something out, and then there turned out to be a bright spot among the product line. Do you want me to tell people what I ended up getting?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're in this dilemma and you're like, think through all your options. So yeah, where'd you end up?
All right, so here's what I did. I looked at all the specs and configurations that I could across everything they made. And the one little booger I had forgotten about in all of this discussion, all this story, was the Mac Mini, which was significantly refreshed after a very long time, pretty recently. And I looked at that thing and went, oh yeah, the Mac Mini. Is it, can that be? I wonder how that is as a pro. You know, I started asking the question. Because I think in the original days, it was like, nah, this is for cheaper people, you know, people that just don't want to spend anything on a Mac. And so they have one little option. They got an old monitor laying around and a mouse and they're good. That's kind of how the original one was positioned. Just like, hey, as entry level as you get, here you go. Get a taste of the Mac. This new one, if you look at the specs, are like, yeah, this is a good processor. That's good memory capacity if you max it out. That's pretty good hard drive options. Like, it's right up there. The only real non-production kind of part of that device is the base video card's pretty lame. It's just a crappy integrated Intel thing. But I also knew that eGPUs, external GPUs, were growing in popularity, and that was an option. So I started looking around at people who were doing that, and it turns out that's way easier than I expected it to be. So what I ended up doing was just configuring one of those with all the options I needed, which was basically I maxed out a Mac Mini as much as big a hard drive as it let me have, which is, it maxes at 2 terabyte. I would have loved 4, but it's fine. Maxed at 64. Oh no, did I do 64 gig or 128? I don't remember. I maxed memory on it because RAM and Mac OS are like best friends. So I did that. And then I just compared that configuration, knowing that Thunderbolt 3 would give me all sorts of other options, right? Like I'd have all kinds of video options and connectivity options and as many, you know, ugly dongles and stuff I needed, because this thing's got like 6 open USB-C based Thunderbolt ports. And so I just knew that I had a lot of expandability that I could do here. It might be ugly, but I could do it. And that meant external drives. It meant eGPUs. It meant everything else. So I configured all that out with the price of a pretty decent entry sort of space eGPU as an ATI in it. And then I compared that price to all the other options. So I looked at the Mac Pro. That was ridiculous. I looked at iMac Pro a little closer. Used ones, maybe better. Refurbs, they're okay. But it wasn't, you know, still none of that was great. And I already had all the mouse, keyboards, and extra displays I need for a lifetime here. So there was never an issue of like, oh, I can't afford a display on this thing. So that was never a thing. And then I compared it also to the notebook, to the the recent 16-inch MacBook that was put out, late last year. And after looking at it all with, you know, nip and tuck here and there, it was not only the best value, but I was right up there in the performance zone I needed to be in. And it was definitely faster than what my Mac Pro from 2013 was going to give me. Is it on the level of like server-based, you know, processors with an 8 terabyte drive or whatever with a Mac Pro? Of course not, right? We're not doing that. But for what I do, this was a perfect middle ground. And it's also sleek, sexy, short, and kind of looks great where it's at on my desktop. Like I traded a small compact design for another small compact design, and I have been thrilled with this. Like, I'm bugged that it's confusing and that it's weird marketing and that it feels like, you know, really a Mac Mini. Like, it feels weird, but it's legit. And with the eGPU attached to it, I'm rendering video files way faster than I did on my Pro. I can play games on here that shouldn't run on here. And it just plugs into a USB-C port and just runs like a little thing. Plus it extends it out and gives me extra ports for other devices, plus other displays if I want, HDMI, DisplayPort, that sort of stuff. And it's just made all the stuff I needed. It's just there. And it was the easiest transition. Started from scratch, reinstalled everything. I decided not to transfer an old backup because sometimes that's weird. And I have just had nothing but good from this decision. It has been amazing, and it does everything I needed to do, and it takes all the ports I needed to take. And I think I only ended up having to get one little USB-C Thunderbolt 3 dongle dock, basically, that gives me a bunch of extra USB 2 ports. This thing only has 2 as default, so I extended that out with that. Added, what else did I add? I'm looking at it right here. Added a couple other things, but it just has been tremendous. And when people ask me now, what are you doing for Mac configuration? I think I'm upgrading. This is absolutely the direction I send them in, despite the fact that I'm not sure Apple really even markets it this way. But it's been great. I'm very happy. And this is probably, if they keep refreshing this device and keeping it relevant, this is probably the upgrade path I take. Just keep going with these. You know, unless they do some mid-range thing, and they may, but you know, doesn't feel like they are.
Yeah, it just, and this is like the big thing that I wanted to talk to you about, because I'm hearing this more and more from people that are in the same space that you're in. You know, it's something I'm even thinking about. So there's a bunch of questions I have now around this, and I don't even know where to start. But I think we'll start with the first one is like, okay, I imagine this configuration, right? Because you're right. We think about the Mac Mini. The way it was marketed to us back in the day was, this is the switcher machine. It's the $500 Mac. It's the Mac that you get when you're coming from a PC and you have a mouse and keyboard and a display and you don't want to invest in the iMac and all this great stuff. And it was great for that. And for a long time, that's kind of what the machine was. They tried to push it a little bit and lost their way. And then they came out with this thing. And I think people still don't know what to make of it. And I think Apple was sort of targeting this more at that pro level person, but they still don't really market it that way. But it seems like a lot of people in your same situation, your peers, are finding it that way. And I told you, I think beforehand, even at my office, you know, we're developers, because a lot of times the pro machines were also developer machines. And our IT staff is having the same sort of thought process go on. They're going, we've invested all this money in monitors and all this other stuff. We have iMacs right now, but they're aging. And what do we buy in the new lineup? Well, iMac Pro is really too much. Mac Pro is way too much. We have budgets. We need good, reliable machines. We use Macs. And literally, my IT guy came to me one day, and he's like, what do you think about the Mac Mini? And we did the same process. We started specking it out and looking at RAM and all the options and went, wow, we can actually probably save money and get better machines. And it became this sort of no-brainer. But at the same time, and what I really, the question I want to ask you is, I would imagine when you specced it out with all the stuff you're talking about, and I'm assuming, did you go for the highest end processor as well? Like, did you upgrade to the i7?
I did. Did I? Hold on. I shouldn't say that. Look real quick. I can tell you in 5 seconds. I did. I upgraded to the i7, the 3.2 gigahertz, 6-core.
Yeah, because that's going to give you the 6 cores. And yeah, I mean, for the type of work. But I mean, even, I shouldn't say even maxed out. So maxed out, and it is 64 gigs of RAM. I would assume you updated the storage, and then you add the eGPU, which I want to ask you about here in a second. But the question I want to get to is, like, did it go through your head, like, I am spending basically what I did on my last Mac Pro, maybe even a little bit more, on a Mac Mini, which I was told back in the day was a sub $500 machine. Like, yeah. Like, what went through your head at that point?
Like, I mean, I definitely felt that. I felt like there were a couple times where I was like, this realization, like, dude, what are you even doing here? Like, we're just starting from the basic thing, but you're doing the accessory bloat that will get you right about where you paid for the other thing. But here's the difference. That normally would say to me, okay, well then get the other thing. Right? Like, if I can figure a Mac Mini up to the point where it's like, oh, geez, this is the cost of my 2013 Mac Pro. Well, the problem is there's no 2019, 2020 Mac Pro to take its place that is in that price range that I could then say, oh yeah, let's not configure the Mac Mini. Let's just go for the Pro because we're already maxing it out. So we may as well just do that. Like, that's just not there to do anymore. And so that's what would push me back and say, no, this is good because this is what they've got. Like, they're, you know, they, in some ways they want you to get that new 16 inch Mac Pro because that thing's priced really well for what it is and for the power it has. And
that MacBook Pro, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. Great. I think you can do 4 terabytes of internal stuff.
Yeah, but you'll pay for that too. Like, that, then you're going to start pushing yourself into iMac Pro territory.
Yeah, and then then you start configuring that thing and you're in Mac Pro territory. Like, it sort of never ends. And maybe that's part of the gig is, you know, that's what they do, is they're just moving you up the chain as you find that you need something. But in this particular case, in one way, I'm like thrilled it exists and that it's a great machine at that level that I can configure in a way that, even though it costs, you know, now right around what I paid for my old Pro, it's giving me all that I needed from my Pro to begin with, or from a Pro upgrade. So they kind of let me configure a Pro from there in a weird way. And that's great. And I'm thrilled about it and I love it, but it's not intuitively the thing that you would do. Like you said, you had somebody go, hey, what do you think about, maybe we start with the Mac Mini? And you're like, oh yeah, we could do. You shouldn't have to come to this realization after 72 hours of thinking about what to do. It should be just like, oh, go to the store. Apple always has a thing you need. Which one is the one you need? Pick it and go. Instead, this is like this. We had to all think about it too hard. And that bums me out a little because it means they don't have an answer for me yet. And then I had to come up with my own answer, and I'm glad I did, but you know.
Well, You know, I think it's interesting because we have to let go that preconception of the boxes that we put Macs in. And this is true for the entire lineup now, I think, right? We had been sold this bill of goods, you know, this sort of, okay, this is your consumer level desktop Mac. This is your pro level desktop Mac. This is your consumer, you know, we had those four boxes that Steve Jobs famously put up at one point, right? Here's your consumer level portable, here's your pro level portable. And it was like real clear. And I think we were educated for a long time on that. And even back then, I always saw that as a little bit of a problem because people would always ask me for recommendations like what Mac should I get? What should I buy? And I think you have to let that go. And I think that's what is happening here, right? You have to realize is that I need to understand what my use cases and my workflows are, and then what my budget is, and then I need to find the configuration, regardless of form factor or what it is. And this sounds like exactly what you did. You find the solution there, and it doesn't matter what box it's in or what it necessarily looks like. I mean, we care as Apple users because we want cool looking stuff, and that's a given. But I mean, from a physicality thing, doesn't matter if it's a round trash can or a big cheese grater thing or this little tiny box. At the end of the day, it matters. Does it have all the things that meet the demands of my workflows? And is it in a price that makes sense for my business?
Exactly right. Yep. I agree with that. And they haven't done that in this particular range since the 2013 Mac Pro. Or I would even argue, oh gosh. I mean, the iMacs have always been, you know, great for what they are when they are, but that at some point that thing stopped being, it's hard to explain. It stopped being the kind of thing that a pro user would want because it slowed down on some of the stuff you need as things move forward, faster ports, better ports, more of those ports, you know, hard drive capacity that was meaningful and also getting away from spinning freaking disk drives and moving toward solid state drives and more RAM. And like, they just feel like they got a little stuck there, and it's a great place because they're affordable. Those screens are incredible. Like it's an amazing position that the iMac continues to hold. But then you just leapfrogged so far up and didn't leave anything in the middle. And I don't know if they know this. I assume they have to have talked about this, or they know that, you know, that there's more there they could do for the middle sumer or whatever we want to call ourselves.
I think just pro, you know, you're still pro users. You're just, it's a different level of pro user, right? It's a different use case. You're not a Hollywood studio. You're not a research science university, you know, like they just recognized that top echelon of the market, which is really probably like 1% of their business, you know, that's where that machine falls now. But it was underserved. I mean, they had been left behind years ago.
For sure. Yeah. That's what I'm arguing is I think they had underswung for years, and now they have overswung. And they just need to go ahead and keep your extremes, no problem. But just do a little something down the middle. Let's call it middle class pros. Because it's all about affordability, and not just affordability, but just like, you know, spending $8,000 on a configuration for what I do is overkill, not just from the price, but from what that machine will do. It's just too much. But an iMac is not enough. Ironically, there's a way to build a mini that is, and it doesn't feel, it almost feels wrong that that's true, but it's true nonetheless.
Yeah. So on that side of things, so the main, just to reiterate, sort of the main deficiencies for in your use case on doing an iMac was just you didn't need the displays, or by the time you were able to configure the SSD storage that you needed, it was just priced out. Like, what was the?
It was priced out to the point that that even with the benefit of a nice display, and those are really nice displays. Because I already have I have a 21:9 big widescreen LG display that I love. I use for all my audio and like time production. And then I have a big, great big, what is this? 38 inch, also an LG, but a 16:9 display that I use as a secondary display on here. I also doubles for my PC game, thing. I just switch inputs when I'm flopping around. And those are not only, those are really great. And so when it came to it, it was like, well, I mean, I could keep configuring this iMac to be somewhere in the equivalent range that I want out of this mini, but now this is way more money and I've got those displays. So if I cut out display, it's going to save that potentially. And then I can spend that on something else like the eGPU or some other ways of beefing this thing up.
Yeah. And so related to that, talk about GPU on the iMac and eGPU. Was that part of this too? Because I know a big complaint about Apple GPUs across the board is they tend to be middle of the road, right? You don't have the option to swap them out. So it feels to me like the eGPU option with a mini, you kind of get the best of both worlds, because that internal GPU, as you already pointed out, is pretty meek for most pro applications. And you need that. But so if you're comparing, I don't know what you ended up with. So that's kind of where I want to go next, is what'd you end up with in the eGPU? And was that part of the decision between, say, like an iMac and a Mac Mini?
So I ended up making a bit of a compromise on the CPU or on the GPU side. I like the Sonnet GPU enclosures. And so there's two ways you can go about this. You can get one. In fact, I think even Apple on their site sells the Blackmagic stuff. Those are, you know, already have a card in them. They're ready to go. I don't think the lower cost one is upgradable, but I think maybe the more costly one is. But anyway, the idea with most eGPUs is that, you know, you buy this enclosure. They can be kind of expensive, you know, $200-$300, whatever, for the enclosure. And the enclosure just allows you to put any GPU in there. You can put an ATI card in there. You can put a, you know, just, it's just a PCI, PC style slot. Card, PCI Express card slot in there with cooling and other stuff to sort of, you know, make sense, plus some extra ports and stuff because Thunderbolt supports all of that. Anyway, so you could put an NVIDIA card in there. You could put ATI cards in there. I keep saying ATI, they're AMD now. But you could put all that stuff in there and then down the road, you're like, oh yeah, I think I need a little more beef out of this. Just swap it out for another card, get another video card, and now you're off to the races. And these are popular, not just in the Mac line. These are really popular anywhere Thunderbolt can be found. So you'll see that somebody with an older Dell notebook who needs some beefy new graphics, this is a great solution for that. It's a great solution for an aging desktop of any kind. So I really like what that is. I love the Thunderbolt technology. USB-C is one of my favorite innovations in PCs and computers in a long, long time. So I was super ready to embrace this idea. I ended up doing a bit of a compromise though, because you know, like I said, it was about $300 or $400 for a good enclosure, but Sonnet, the brand Sonnet, also carries something called the EGFX breakaway puck, and it has in there an RTX, a Radeon RX 560S, which is miles better than the cards that were in my my Mac Pro. It's not the fastest card on the market by any stretch, and it's permanent in there. So this is the card. But it's only $400 with the card. So the whole solution is just done. And will I have to get another one in 5-6 years? Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, the other way was going to cost me roughly the same. So it was another good price reason that I pulled that. So they call it the breakaway puck. And they call it that because it's pretty small. It's smaller than the actual Mac Mini in terms of footprint. It just sort of sits alongside it. Has a USB-C port to the Thunderbolt port in the back of the Mac Mini. The other thing I wanted to sing the praises of is Mac OS now just sees these things and immediately uses them. There's just nothing to do. You plug it in and a little tiny chip icon shows up in your, you know, your upper right dashboard stuff. And it just now says disconnect AMD Radeon RX 570. That's the only option there. And everything sees it and uses it that needs 3D acceleration of any kind. It's as if the card is in the machine, and I love that. I think that is so rad. And, you know, again, creates more ports as well. So I'm running my second monitor off of its HDMI port. It also has 4 display ports. It can run up to 5 displays, I think. And it crunches everything faster. I compared all the time it took to make a video in Premiere and to export in, just with the built-in Intel card. And then I compared that to this, and it was just night and day. Like, huge amounts of time saved with this new thing. So I've been very happy with it, and it didn't break the bank. Like 400 is, it's not throwaway money, but it was definitely less than any of the other options I configured out. And I like it a lot. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, this thing looks cool. How did it compare to your previous Pro? And then, what is your video workflow? Are you working in 1080p, working in 4K?
Like a little of both. So if I've got raw video that's already 4K, like some of the video game footage I take and edit down or whatever, I'll output in that as well. So if I put it on YouTube or whatever, if I've already got it in 4K, I will absolutely export in 4K. If I'm, you know, some of my show stuff is just streaming at 1080p and I only record at 1080p. So any edits to that sort of thing, I keep it that as well. But it's night and day between this and the other, the Mac Pro. I mean, you could argue, and this is one of the problems people had back in the day, but the base, they came with two cards, the Mac Pro trash can. They were built in, and they were this custom thing from AMD again.
Those Fire Pro cards or whatever they called them.
Yeah. And they were okay for their time, but they kind of were already not the best thing when that came out. They were already kind of considered a mid to lower solution. And so they weren't amazing at that sort of crunchy stuff. But when I compare the two, this, what I'm doing now with this breakaway box is way faster. I don't have actual benchmark data to tell you, but I can tell you that just the same videos are taking, you know, a tenth of the time that the Mac Pro took.
I mean, those are the numbers that matter more, right? I mean, when you're a pro, it's great to look at. I mean, it's fun to look at all these tech numbers and say, oh, this is, you know, 60% faster, 20% faster, does this many, you know, takes this many minutes or something like that. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, when I finish my production, how long is it taking me to get that video out and get that up on YouTube, which is where you want it to be, right? Or wherever you're sending it off to.
Right. Exactly. I agree with that 100%. And for me, the flow has just been working. Not once since I've had this setup have I gone, oh, this part takes forever. Or, oh man, I wish that file moved faster. Just being in a completely SSD environment now and having this box connected, I just feel like I'm right there now. And, you know, ask me in 4.5, 5 years how I'm doing, and maybe I'm looking at another upgrade. I don't know, but it doesn't feel like I'm behind the eight ball already. And whenever I would get an iMac in the past, I felt like I was already a little bit behind, just a tiny bit behind on a performance level of some sort or another. And again, I'm not saying that's bad. In fact, those are great. I know people have had an iMac for 10 years and they're still using it the way they've always used it, but they're not doing the stuff I'm doing. And so it's for them. It's perfectly for them. And what's for me doesn't exist without a little bit of goofing around with a mini at the price I need it to be.
I think we touched on some of the little things, but I'm curious because it sounds like overall it's been a positive experience moving from the Pro to the Mini. Is there anything that was kind of, you know, that we haven't already talked about that was maybe a little bit painful or something you wish could be a little bit better? Or
I like that question because, I mean, nothing's ever perfect, right? And I've been, you know, in the last couple of years, if I've been anything, I've been more critical of Apple's decisions with certainly with desktop, and just, you know, also the industry is shifting and changing and it always is doing that. And, you know, Apple's success in mobile and their success with portable and the infiltration of, you know, notebooks into the market and becoming the dominant notebook, you know, that stuff it's informed where they put their time, right? Or where they put their efforts and their design and everything else. And desktop is just not a dying thing, but it's not what it used to be. And that's okay. It's normal. It's like what phones are entering that phase now of just sort of simple iteration. It's no longer the crazy leaps forward that they used to make. And I'm okay with that. And I understand it and I see it for what it is, but I have been frustrated and openly so that they, you know, that it felt like they were just not prioritizing a certain market. Which I know I've said 100 times here, but I'll say it again. It's just, you were not prioritizing, or at least making me feel like I had a place in their lineup. And I've never felt that way until now. And it really bummed me out for a while. So the reason I say all that is that still remains the one sore spot of any of this, because the actual solution, what I ended up doing, the transition. The day I got it, it took like no time to get up and running. Everything moved over the way I needed it to. All my old hardware that I had to pipe into this thing was fine. My mixers and my audio converter stuff and all this stuff, just no problems. Just across the board, piece of cake. Zip. Zero issues. In fact, a few issues I had with the Mac Pro, mostly to do with, again, performance stuff, went away. They were annoying things like, if I'm doing a show, I might get some weird staticky sounds. And you could tell it was like CPU or something just struggling to do multiple things at once. And that's gone. You know, I don't have any of that stuff anymore. Like, everything else about this has been a 100% positive experience. That machine makes no noise. I don't know how it's doing heat dispersion. I hope it doesn't melt, but it's doing amazing that way. You know, Apple's pretty good at that stuff, so not too worried. But yeah, I just don't have a complaint about any of it except for that sinking feeling of how I had to get here.
Right. You sort of had to search for the solution you were looking for, and you ended up in a good place, but it was that it wasn't really obvious is what I'm hearing. And I don't want to speak for you, but
right. It almost felt like it almost made me just nervous. Like, do they know how bad I need this? Or do they know how bad I need them to be here for me? You know, I feel this way about every day that goes by, and I'm just like, I'm in wonder at how truly wonderful a creation tool the combination of an iPad Pro, a pencil, and something like Procreate are. It's changed my life, my production art life, just changed it for the positive. And every day I go, it's like I want to say a little prayer to Zeus and say, please don't let, or please make sure Apple doesn't not know this and like goes a different direction and jacks this up somehow, because man, it's so good right now. I don't want them to make a left turn and forget and not notice that they are. And I don't think it's possible that they will. The number one paid app on iPad for the last 2.5 years is Procreate. There's a reason. It's amazing. It's the artist tool of choice. Everybody loves it. It's driving companies like Adobe to do better. You know, like, it's a really amazing thing. And I know Apple sees those numbers and they know how well it does. So I hope that they just see what they've made here and they don't F it up because I love it so much. And so that's kind of this weird sense I get, because as they swing toward mobile, they swing toward services and wearables and all that. It's all good. I love that stuff. I just don't want these other things, which I know are more boutique these days. They're more specialized for people like me and you. I know that. They're not mass market necessarily. I just don't want them to forget us. And I hope that we continue to be a good portion of their revenue so that they don't forget us. And you don't want to be that guy that buys into something that's just awesome, but no one ever else picks it up. And then you find out later, well, we got to cancel that because no one liked it. It's like your favorite TV show or something. You still want it. Please don't cancel it. Please, please. I love the show. It's like that.
I think we're in danger of that. I think the iPad Pro and the pencil have a long,
good
longevity.
Good. My other reason for loving that thing is I think it drives other, it drives like Wacom, it drives Apple or Microsoft with the Surface line and others improve their quality and improve their products. Then none of them compare right now, but they may get there, because they really need to compete with this thing. I mean, it is legitimately amazing. And I remember back in the day when like Jobs was like opposed to pens and styluses. I'm glad that whoever made the decision to do it did, because I mean, it really, maybe I wouldn't know any better if it never happened. Okay. I just wouldn't worry about it. And I just keep working the way I work, but that altered my art, my digital art trajectory permanently. So don't take it away, Apple, is all I'm saying.
Permanently, and it sounds like in a positive way, more importantly.
In a very positive way. Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I bought all in on it, which is, you know, you love to do that with Apple. It's like one of the reasons the faithful love them. They hit the mark sometimes. And when they do, it's like, man, what was life like before this thing? They've changed my life. And I love that. It's easy to get cynical about a company this big and this old, but I love that. And that they can still do it is amazing. And in a weird way, I feel like I helped to do it with this mini discovery, but I really wish they would have had me in mind and would have thought ahead about all that.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that experience and that sort of transition with us. Cause that's something I heard you talk about this on your show and I was like, Scott would be the perfect person to talk about this. Cause you came from that place where you were entrenched, you know, for several years with the desktop pros. And it was interesting to hear your story. And thank you for coming on here to share it with us. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's Adam. Just jumping in here real quick. We're going to get right back to the interview with Scott, but I want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is ExpressVPN. Look, I know there's a ton of VPN providers out there. You've probably heard of a couple of them. Maybe you even used some of them before. But for me, this is the one that I have been currently using, and I like to do a lot of research about my sponsors, and I don't recommend brands lightly. So if you hear me in a spot saying that I use a product, I do use it. I vet it. I can say with full confidence that ExpressVPN is the best VPN on the market. And there's a number of reasons for that. Data protection, right? Protecting your data. ExpressVPN doesn't log your data. Lots of really cheap or free VPNs, they make money by selling your data to ad companies. That's part of the game. ExpressVPN actually developed a technology called Trusted Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log any of your info. So if you're using a VPN, likely the reason you're using it is for security and privacy. Another one is speed. I've tried a lot of VPNs in the past, and they can slow your connection down. I have been using ExpressVPN, and I don't experience that. My internet speeds continue to be fast, even when I'm connected to VPNs. I have been able to stream HD quality video and not have any problems, and that's a tough thing to do on a lot of VPNs. Lastly, ExpressVPN is super easy to use. And this is probably for me the most important one. I need something that I can literally flip a switch, know that I'm protected, and it needs to be that easy. Unlike other VPNs, you don't have to input or program anything with ExpressVPN. You download the app, do it to your iOS device, to your Mac, doesn't matter. It's easy to set up on either. You fire up the application, one click, you're connected, and you're secure in using a VPN. And I'm not the only one saying this. TechRadar, The Verge, CNET, and many other tech experts rate ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with the VPN that I use and trust. Use my link, expressvpn.com/maccast today to get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year package. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/maccast to sign up and learn more. And a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their support of the show. Let's get back to talking with Scott. We're going to do a little shift in the conversation and talk to him a little bit more, this time about gaming. I do want to wrap up with something maybe a little more fun. So I want to transition from like pro workflows to talking, because I know another big part of a lot of the stuff you do is video games and video gaming, and you do video game streams, and you're a PC gamer. You already mentioned you have a PC thing, and I know you've done console stuff, although I think you're more on the PC side. But I also know that you've for a long time been a pretty big fan, and you did a podcast related to this, of also more casual games like iOS games and things like that. And Apple is moving into services, right? And one of those places where it seems like they're trying to grow and get a little angle into and maybe expand on the success of iOS is with Apple Arcade, which I subscribe to and I love, but I've always just been a casual gamer. So I'm curious to get your perspective on Apple Arcade coming from that place of, you know, gamer that sort of spans the breadth of all the kinds of gaming that's out there.
Yeah, it's how long are we into this thing now? When did they launch it? Last year in April, July or something? Or I don't remember when they did.
No. Yeah, I'd have to go back and check. It was before the other, TV came out in November, but I think it was back around Worldwide Developer Conference, maybe not long after Worldwide Developer Conference, summer. Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, maybe as early as March. Yeah, March or April. That's true. Well, okay. So whenever it was, they kind of had me pretty peaked on the idea early, because what they were promising was this great sort of curated part of mobile gaming that would rid itself from things like microtransactions and free to play and loot boxes and all this crap that we're all sick of with the free to play market. And it's so entrenched in mobile, it just seemed like we were never going to get out of there. And this was like a really interesting initiative to pull out of that and still make it profitable for those involved, but at the same time, deliver games that gamers are more interested in playing. And I think to a large extent, they pulled it off. For me, what I've learned over this amount of time since it's been out is that quality does make a difference. Good developers make a difference. Apple giving this space for these things to be discovered and found and be part of a service like this, all of this stuff's making a great difference. The one hangup that I think I still have about all of it is that it's still, at the end of the day, for the most convenient use of the thing, it's still you and your phone. And yes, you can sync PS4 and Xbox One controllers to it and other third-party controllers. Like, yes, that's a thing, and that's great that they're doing that, and I love that. But most people are going to be on the train. They got their phone. The touchscreen's all they've got. And you're reminded immediately, yeah, it's just not the way gamers like to play games. They just don't like touchscreens. Now, some games lend themselves really well to it. Things like Hearthstone and other kind of card battler games. Those are great for that. Now, there's other examples that I can't think of at the moment. But, you know, if you want to play a good 3D platformer, you're stuck with a touchscreen control, it's just the age-old problem of that's just not the optimal way to do it. The optimal way to do it is joysticks and analog sticks and buttons and D-pads and, you know, controllers. It's what we're used to. And it's what gamers want. They want that kind of tactical sort of control over their game. And they, like I said, they can do it, but imagine that same guy on the train, he's got to take a controller with him. Are you going to get a mount for the screen? Are you going to attach it to the controller somehow? I mean, they make stuff like that, but you're going to go through the trouble of buying these accessories. Like, there's a lot of middleware there for the experience. And it's not a perfect solution or situation. All of that being said, for the fact that it is what it is, and that's the format we have, right? Touchscreens are what we've got. I think it's an incredible service within that constraint, if that makes sense. What they are doing is really strong for mobile. And I think that's about as far as it extends. And that's good enough, I think. I think, I think it's kind of goal achieved. I don't know what the numbers look like. I have no idea. But I've been pretty happy with it. I've seen some games that I didn't discover any other way. I'll admit this, though. Some games show up on Apple Arcade. Maybe even first, I'm like, oh, this is really cool. Man, I wish this was on PC. And then about a week later, I'll find out that same game's on PC. And I'll go, sure. Oh, geez, I'll just play it over there. And I've rebought games on Steam or whatever because the mouse and the keyboard are better suited, or a real controller is better suited, or a bigger screen is better suited, or whatever it is to make that a more, a better purchase. They're just better on other platforms. So in a weird way, it's become a way for me to test things that I will get somewhere else and play more there, which I didn't expect. That was kind of a weird.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to hear because, you know, not all the titles are exclusive. Obviously, I think most of them actually aren't exclusive. They occasionally get ones in different time frames. But that idea that you can use your subscription as a way to discover a game and then buy it someplace else isn't necessarily a negative thing, right? Especially from a developer's perspective, because they're getting money from Apple Arcade, and then now they're getting more money from you again on another platform because you discovered it on Apple Arcade. So I like the fact that it's good for developers, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's there's a game called, I think it's Spaceland, I think is the name, that is just wonderful on desktop, on a computer, and it's okay on phones. It's this turn-based strategy thing. But again, it's tiny screen. It's the kind of game I'd rather be in front of longer, but phones just don't, you know, you're sort of just casually picking it up. Like you said, the games that lean into this as a casual format, usually the ones that do the best, you know, here's a quick word game and they're very popular. Or here's Candy Crush. Why do people pay that a ton? Well, it's addicting and it's quick and you can get sessions in and turn it down and then take a phone call. And, you know, the games that are a little bit more elaborate, and there have been plenty on arcade, and I love more elaborate games. Some of them just make me wish they were on. Like here's an example of an exclusive on the service that I wish I could get on PC or Switch or something else. and that is Sneaky Sasquatch, which is this amazing, weird game on Apple Arcade and only Apple Arcade. Plays really well with a controller, I should mention. But again, you know, you have all those limits of having your phone and a controller in the same place at the same time, that sort of thing. It's so good and so much fun and can take up so much of your time, but you just are stuck with where it is. If that game was on PC, I'd have already bought it or purchased it.
So let me ask you this, because I haven't done this, honestly, and maybe you're in the same boat as me, and maybe it's just something we forget, but these are all playable on the Mac.
Oh, right. So I should mention, this is a good thing you brought that up. Some of them play very poorly there. Well, okay, here's a thing I haven't done since this transition to the Mini and all this new setup, and especially the eGPU. I have not played any Apple Arcade games on my Mac since that change, but I played a bunch when it was on the Pro, and they performed horribly. They were really slow and bad. And again, I think it's just aging video cards, and you know, the video processors inside of your phone are faster than these ATR cards from 2013. Yeah. Or they're just not optimized. I don't know, but it definitely, I assume it would make a big difference if I played them now. So that's a really good point. Like, I guess technically I do have it on computer. I just forgot.
Yeah. But the question is, do the, and I don't know the answer to this because I haven't tried, are the games sophisticated enough to adapt the controls for the platform? So if I play it on my Mac, is it still like trackpad or mouse and you know, maybe a connected, you know, Bluetooth connected game controller as my options for control, or are there actually like keyboard controls in there, which might be important for certain games? So I haven't tested that, you know, I have no idea, but now I'm definitely going to, now I just honestly forget, because it felt like so much of a mobile thing, like you were mentioning earlier, that, oh yeah, these are on the Mac. Maybe that's worth discovering.
Yeah, no, it is worth messing with. There are some that I think are better for that than others. I would say Sneaky Sasquatch, which I'm now redownloading because you've reminded me of all this, is a good example of that, and I can't wait to like pick that up again. And also all the cloud saves going back and forth, and you having whatever progress you made on the phone will now transfer here. That's all great. Like, that's the future. That's the way these things should be. And I'm going
to
play it today.
Getting back to the controller thing. So something I have been a little bit impressed by, because I had bought at some point a PlayStation controller, I think for Minecraft, or it might even been just to try out Fortnite on my Mac, and it never worked very well. I was never that impressed with it, but I had this extra controller, and I also have a SteelSeries Nimbus that I got for my Apple TV back when they started bringing Apple TV games. But Apple Arcade has changed my Apple TV experience with playing games, because a lot of those games do support controllers on Apple TV. And so now that I have a couple controllers, for me, again, recognizing I'm coming from this place of just a casual gamer, I don't play a lot of games, but I'm discovering and playing a lot more on my Apple TV as almost a console experience. And
yeah, I know some people that are almost exclusively playing, like their world of gaming is a PlayStation 4 controller that they just happen to have synced to their Apple TV playing Apple Arcade games. That's not as crazy as it may even sound.
And so, like, one I picked up recently that I think is great with a controller is Yaga.
Oh yeah, Yaga's good.
Yeah. And so I'm enjoying discovering that, and my daughter and I together are playing the cat adventure one, and I'm
Gonna remember. I have this, hold on. It's Cat Quest 2.
Yeah. And so we'll get in there and we'll do that, and that's been really fun. Where I've been a little bit disappointed with some of the Apple Arcade games is you'll find ones that say, "Oh, they're multiplayer." But the way that they're multiplayer is everybody has to be on their own device. Right. And so even though like the Apple TV supports like up to 8 controllers, I think it's 4 or 8. I don't remember specifically, but you'll think, OK, great, I can get the whole family in the room and we can play a 4-player game. And then you find out, nope, you know, someone has to play on their iPad or their and only one person gets to play on the Apple TV. And it's more like an online game that's not really quite online because it's only Apple. And it's great that, I have a family, so it's a family plan, so everybody can download the app, but it's kind of not the experience that I'm necessarily looking for in like a multiplayer party game, especially.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, honestly, the best part, well, this may be true of actually every platform. The greatest party games ever made are these Jackbox games that you can play on, and anyone with a phone or a tablet or a browser can play no matter where they are.
Yeah, but you're still sharing that main screen, right? So you're still all on, and that's the thing. Like at that point, it's just kind of a controller, whereas this is like your gaming experience. And the one great example I have of this is because I thought it was going to be a lot like Smash Brothers, right? Is the Lego, they have the Lego game where it's kind of like Lego Brawls, right? And it's like multiplayer, but everybody has to be on their own like little device. It's not, four of you controlling four people on the big screen TV.
Yeah, which is,
Weird.
it's that's weird. Yeah,
Right? For
it
that
is
kind of
weird.
game.
Totally agree. For that kind of game, I mean, my opinion is it shouldn't be like that for that kind of game.
Yeah. So, but overall, I've been really happy with Apple Arcade. So the last thing I want to ask you about is in light of, because there, it seems to me like there are some other platforms kind of coming into a similar space, but it's from a different area. So I guess what I'm trying to understand is how you think Apple fits into this sort of changing dynamic of it's not necessarily mobile gaming, but we're starting to see gaming services that are like streaming games, like these little boxes that hook to your TV. You've got a library of titles, and that's sort of what Apple Arcade is, but Apple Arcade is different from those. But so does Apple have a space in there? Like, how does that all fit in and fit together? And I'm thinking of things like, what's the Google thing called Strava or
Stadia. Yeah.
Stadia. Yeah. Or, I know Nvidia has a thing.
They all sound like drugs your doctor tells you to try.
Right.
So the Nvidia one was just launched a week ago. The Nvidia GeForce Now service is pretty impressive. I've been messing with that. On an old freaking MacBook that plays no games, I was able to play beautiful full screen 60 frame per second, just amazing looking stuff on that service. It's very impressive. It's also very cool because it just collects all the games you already own and doesn't make you pay for them. You just play them. And all your cloud saves and everything. Yeah, it just takes your Steam library or Uplay or Epic or whatever and just says, hey, you own this. You want to play it? You just play it and you can play it on anything. Although iOS support's still coming, it's not done yet. That stuff seems to always take longer than Android. But anyway. Yeah, this is a thing, right? Like even Steam has a remote play option for your phone from a PC in the house. It's not a service online, but it's, if you got a PC in your house on your network and you've got your phone and your Wi-Fi going, you can stream any Steam game to your phone or your iPad, get a controller and boom, you're in. So that's already a thing. And these services are just going to get more and more popular. Microsoft's got xCloud all queued up and ready to roll pretty soon here this year. And Stadia is expanding with a kind of a soft launch last year. They got a lot more to show this year. And then, of course, GeForce Now and others. There's also Shadow PC, where you literally rent a remote PC every month for like $12. And that remote PC is literally a full computer with a very high-end video card that you. When you launch it, you have a desktop and you're running Windows and you install your games and you play your games. That's a lot more affordable than buying a brand new box every couple of years to have the latest PC games play on them. And as long as you've got good internet, it's at, the technology delivers. It's pretty strong. So all of that being said, Apple probably doesn't have something ready for this in general. A lot of people thought that when they announced Arcade, that's what it would be, is some sort of streamable thing. I'm not surprised it isn't. They basically are still in the world of you install a thing and play it. And that's not going away, entirely very soon. I mean, years from now it will, but right now that's still, that's the dominant way you get your content. So it's not like they're not out of their element yet, but I do think it would behoove them at some point to maybe invest somewhat in that kind of infrastructure. Because imagine a world where Apple Arcade was just a giant list of games. And if you chose to do it, you could just play them now. Don't install them. Don't have to download them. You don't have to worry about whether you're on Wi-Fi or 5G or wherever you're at. You just play them immediately. Like, there's a future in that. And whether they hop onto that probably depends on how successful Arcade is overall. And I think so far they're making money. So maybe. So I guess the answer is maybe. I think it's a weird space for Apple because it's not gaming centric outside of this space. Whereas all these other services we've talked about are like, you know, big name, hardcore, you know, console.
But are those really more targeted, you think, at PC gamers versus it feels like Apple's maybe carved out a space? I guess the question I want to get to is it a space worth being carved out? Like, is there money left on the table that maybe Apple's picking up? Or do you think this is just an early play from Apple and the longer term game might be to move more into that PC space? And I really don't know. I'm looking at this going, I think there's enough of a little space that Apple Arcade sits in that's for people more like me and probably less like you, you know, where it's like, I want a little more gaming, but I don't have time to go, you know, full bore and, you know, $5 a month. Hey, that's, I would normally buy one. The way I justified it was, hey, I buy probably one iOS game or title a month. That's probably $5. So now I have 100 to choose from and it's still $5.
Right? Yeah. I think what this boils down to is they have, well, historically Apple gets up to the edge of gaming and then peers over and does a little something and then pulls back. They had the Pippin at one point, although I think that was the non-Jobs years.
Yeah, it was only Japan, I think. Yeah,
it lasted like 5 minutes. It didn't work out. But on the desktop side, they, you know, there are many wonderful, amazing old Macintosh games. And the closer they got to supporting that, it was great. It was like, oh my gosh, the platform is going to be a great place for gamers. And then they would not do things that were conducive to growing the gaming side, and they'd go a different direction. And so we're like, all right, well, things are hopping over here on PC, so we'll go there. They've had that kind of curve their whole existence. And the only time it's ever stuck is mobile. That's the only time, because they fell into that. Like, that wasn't a thing. I don't think they were very strategic about it. It just happened to their dominant platform for games and apps. So it made sense that, you know, that was just going to happen under their watch, and it did. And thankfully they've supported it well. I think they've innovated well there in terms of services to make it possible to do a lot of things. You could argue it changed the whole world, and it's the biggest gaming platform on the planet, because it is. Mobile has just killed it. You know, it's killed it. Whether people love it or not is a different issue, but there's plenty of it going on just by the numbers. So they did that all right. But then even on desktop, they keep inching toward it. It's like, oh, we got Metal now. Metal, everybody. That's our new rendering thing. We're going to be right up there. These eGPUs especially, they're going to put us right up there with PCs. You won't have to compromise. And then they just kind of don't go all the way, you know, they kind of just pull back again. They don't make the relationships. And
Microsoft comes in and buys the company that's going to
give
them their next huge title. That was my biggest disappointment in gaming, because I was a huge fan of Marathon.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, Bungie's going to make Halo for the Mac, and it's going to be this Mac exclusive thing. And then like, oh, no, Microsoft bought them.
Yep. For a hot minute, that was a Mac game and it was going to be great. And it would have been. But they, you know, the writing was on the wall. Other forces intervened. And if Apple really wanted to, they could prioritize this stuff. They could say all new Macs have this level of video card in the minimum, and they are fast, and they are doing this and that. But they just don't prioritize it. It's just not, it's never been a priority for them on that side of it. But tablets and phones, it's absolutely a priority. And you see it in the kind of chips they design, because they need these to perform really fast. They need 3D rendering to look amazing on mobile, and they do. Like, it's clear that the investment is there for that, and they could the other way. They just never have. Steve, doesn't seem like Jobs ever cared that much about the gaming side of any of it.
But is Apple TV or Apple Arcade the genesis of that mobile gaming? Like, is it the next step, do you think, or not? Because I'm kind of feeling like that's what Apple thinks it might be, but I don't know if it's proved to itself.
Yeah, I don't know if it has either. Like, I'm kind of with you, but I kind of feel like it's proved itself in that it was a worthy exercise, no matter what the outcome. Like, this is a logical, cool idea to say, hey, it's a bit of a overgrowth right now. Like the mobile scene, it's impossible to sort of discover new things that are amazing. They get drowned out by ridiculous, you know, oversaturation of free to play games, and like it's just
buying berries or
yeah, buying Smurf
coins or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Right? So you feel like you're in the weeds all the time, and this is them saying, "Well, what if we? You still have the weeds because some people like the weeds, so enjoy the weeds. But what about over here for a little bit of a premium? Not too much though. Small cost of a cup of coffee. What if we had, you know, this curation, this careful discovery system, this you know, opportunity for showcasing games that stand out and that are more than just quick throwaway, junky, whatever. Like that feels like a very worthy endeavor to me. And I'm really glad they're doing it. Whether it takes off is still a market question, but or has taken off. I mean, their services numbers are so way up, it's hard to say where it's coming from the most, but I assume it's a contributor in a meaningful way. I hope they continue to innovate on top of it and maybe expand and branch it out. The fact that these games are available on every platform they make, including Max, is a huge step in a direction that Apple, I wouldn't have predicted 10 years ago they'd ever do. That's just crazy talk. Like, yeah. Apple getting that into it. So yeah, like I couldn't be more pleased about this decision. The question is whether or not it's truly as groundbreaking as they would like us to think it is. It's definitely, you know, this is the place for this though. Nobody else is really doing this. This sort of thing's not, you know, Android's a nightmare on the gaming side. It just is it's all over the place. Multiple phone manufacturers, different performance, different experience on each one. I mean, it's back to the old PC issue. And so for them to fix that, they're going to have to unify somehow. They're going to have to do like Microsoft did with Windows and say, all right, well, here's a common graphics language thing. Here's DirectX. And we're going to iterate on that and make it so that these graphics libraries and stuff are just universal. So whoever's making your game, you'll pretty much be able to make it for whatever the configuration is and you know, different settings for different power and all that. Like those kinds of things are easy on the Apple side because they can, it's a single hardware platform that, sure, older ones age out, but you can control how these perform on each generation in a much more uniform way than on Android, which is just all over the place. And there are advantages to Android, of course. I'm not saying there isn't. You're going to get, I don't want you to get emails from people because they're out there, but, but you know what I mean? Like it's, they don't have a curation option like this. Although I guess Google's got something in the works. I forgot what the deal was. They've got something with Google Play where there might be a subscription based thing for, you know, a more quality selection of games that are more handpicked, a bit, you know, basically following this lead.
Yeah. I think it's a good model. I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. And if they do it, that may prove out Apple was right. That's the other thing is if you see Google do it, that's usually them going, oh crap, we're missing out on some of this. We got to do this. And that probably means Apple's been more successful than we know.
Yeah. I mean, they're good at that. And again, I think they kind of carved out the space and we'll have to wait to see what that all means. Cool. Well, I think that's all I got for you, Al. Thank you again for agreeing to come on. I should probably get you on more frequently. But just sharing that process and journey of, you know, what you're doing with your pro stuff. I guess wrapping up, you want to let people know, you know, the results of all those efforts. Is there anything you want to tell people about, maybe promote a little bit?
Yeah, there's everything's at frogpants.com. And if you've heard any of my stuff, you'll kind of know what you're getting into over there. But if you're looking for shows and cool art stuff and everything else, that's the home base for it. But I did launch, speaking of actual production stuff, I launched a new comic strip for the first time in like 15 years. And it's a weird one. It's called Fred and Can. And it's about a guy named Fred who lives with a can of sentient expired cream corn. And literally, and this can talks to him. He talks to it. Who knows if he can really talk because we don't know yet. Or maybe Fred's just crazy, but anyway, it's about their life together and their experiences together. So far it's three episodes of strips, which you can find at fredcancomic.com or at frogpants.com. There's a link there. And, there's lots of ways to get it. You can get an RSS feed for it. You can get a monthly email that just shows up or not monthly, weekly, sorry, that just shows up in your inbox. Or if you'd prefer to get it on Instagram or whatever, it's all available, every Monday. and it's called Fred and Can, and it's just as weird as you think it is. So let me know what you think of it. It's again at fredcancomic.com.
I'll tell you, I'm enjoying them, and I will make a plug for, because I think it's brilliant creatively what you've done in terms of, you talked about this a little bit on your show, but the fact that sort of how comics were thought of in the past, you know, web comics as being like this thing, you got to go to a website and have this place, but now you've realized, you know, it should just kind of be everywhere. I'm going to plug the Instagram because I follow you on Instagram. That's where I saw it first. And what I love is because it's still like your traditional panel format comic, I like the fact that on Instagram, it comes in sort of one panel at a time and you can just kind of flip through them. And I think that's brilliant. It works really well.
Yeah, we just use the multi-photo option on Instagram turns out to be a very great comic delivery mechanism.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And, you know, they could change that any minute, but for now it works as a really great way to show that thing. So yeah, I would actually recommend that as well. I like the idea that you're getting them one at a time. Your eyes aren't tempted to jump ahead and get visual clues about how things are going to end. You just kind of get the story as you flip, and it's a fun way to do that. It makes me want to experiment more with that kind of thing. But we're consuming so much of this stuff on our phones. It's just not the old days anymore. It's not a newspaper with a four panel spread of a wide thing. These days, if you're on your phone, you get a wide strip. It's a nightmare to read that thing. You got to zoom in and, you know, it's a pain. So,
you know, it was funny too. Like when I saw the first one, you were brilliant and smart in knowing that I'm assuming this is only on the Instagram one, but you have the little arrow that says swipe.
Yeah. Yeah.
As like the indicator, and I'm like, how did is that a new programming thing in Instagram, or like how do you do? Oh wait, no, he just drew that on there. It's like, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't want people to get confused and not know what to do next, like they were getting just the one panel, because you know the interface stuff on Instagram is kind of subtle. It's like little dots and it's faded out. You don't really always know that there's more panels. So I was like, yeah, you better swipe if you're going to go to the next one, and I'm going to do that on all of them just because. Why not?
Yeah, it was perfect. It was a great like little visual indicator. First I thought my mind went, oh, it's something programmatically done. No, it's just like, oh yeah, that's cool. Anyway, so
yeah, I'm very, very pleased with how that thing turned out. So yeah, I'd love people's feedback if you can check it out. It's gone really well so far. I'm a little surprised, to be honest, how well it's gone. It's apparently hitting a bit of a nerve for some. So check it out, fredcancomic.com, and that Instagram account that he was talking about is over at Actual Scott on Instagram, but it's all linked on the
very site. Cool. Check it all out, and frogpants.com is the main portal for everything. So thanks again, Scott. I really appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
My pleasure, 100%. Thanks, Adam.
There you have it, Scott Johnson from Frog Pants Network. If you haven't caught any of his shows, I really do recommend that you head over and check them out. Like I said, a couple of my favorites, The Morning Stream, which is a daily morning show. He does that with Brian Ibbett of Coverville fame, another great podcaster and great show to check out if you're into cover songs. But they do a really fun show every day, 4 days a week. And it's something great to throw on in the car, especially if you have a commute or something like that, which is where I listen to it most frequently. And also Film Sack, where they cover just quirky streaming films that you can watch online. And four of them get together, they watch the film, and they do what they call sacking it. And it's usually something really campy or old. You know, a lot of those 80s nostalgia movies that we love that, you know, you go back and watch and you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I ever thought this was really great. And it's just a fun show. And that's just two of the, you know, plethora of podcasts that Scott puts out. I don't know how he does it. He's actually prolific. So check out all his content, frogpants.com. And a big thank you to him for coming on and talking with us about his transition to the Mac Mini as a pro platform. And I, you know, like I said in there, we're doing this at my office as well. We had programming machines on iMacs. We're moving to Mac Minis, and it is a great option and one that I don't think a lot of us really think about. So I'd love to know what you think about this. If you're using a Mac Mini as a pro system or considering it, did this help you out? Shoot me some feedback, send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank My show sponsor, Smiles, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, instagram.com/MacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.